We're going to be in John chapter 20, if you haven't already guessed that. I guess it's on the screen behind me, isn't it? We're going to continue the story that we started a little bit ago. If you don't have a Bible, there are Bibles all throughout the pews you're welcome to use. And if you don't own a Bible, please take the one that's there in front of you with you as our gift to you. Words will also be on the screen as we follow along, beginning in verse 11 of John chapter 20. Now Mary stood outside the tomb crying. As she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb and saw two angels in white, seated where Jesus' body had been, one at the head and the other at the foot. They asked her, "Woman, why are you crying?" "They have taken my Lord away," she said, "and I don't know where they have put him." At this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but she did not realize it was Jesus. He asked her, "Woman, why are you crying? Who is it you are looking for?" Thinking he was the gardener, she said, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have put him, and I will get him." Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned toward him and cried out in Aramaic, "Rabboni," which means teacher. Jesus said, "Do not hold on to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father. Go instead to my brothers and tell them I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." Mary Magdalene went to the disciples with the news, "I have seen the Lord." And she told them that he had said these things to her. Word of God for the people of God. Hopefully on the way in you got to pick up, or maybe you were handed one of these yellow sheets. On the front, as always, are a place to take notes or things you want to remember to write down. On the back are questions to use in your own reflection or in your small group studies, and then scriptures to read throughout the week. It's dark and it's quiet. The sun has not yet risen and everyone is still waking up after the Sabbath rest. It's Sunday morning in a world where darkness meant you pretty much stayed put until light came. It wasn't always safe to travel in the dark in those days. And yet, there in the garden are three women who are moving about with determination and dedication. Their friend, Jesus, had been executed just days ago and hurriedly buried in a borrowed tomb by their friends Joseph and Nicodemus. Mary Magdalene had been one of those who stayed till the end, until the moment when the huge rolling stone was locked into place and all hope was gone. Jesus was dead. He was gone. And everything he had taught and said and lived out seemed to be gone too. There was only one thing left to do, really. Finish the burial. Because sundown had been approaching and the Sabbath was beginning, his burial had been quick and incomplete. So these women then come to the tomb with the spices and oils they need to give Jesus a proper burial. I say this every Easter, but I want you to hear me clearly. They are coming to the tomb to anoint a corpse. Despite the fact that Jesus had promised several times that he was going to rise again, nobody expected a resurrection. These women don't come to the tomb to see if he's raised. They come to take care of the body of a dear friend. The men don't even bother to get out of bed, but the women come to the tomb. Now, it is true that some Jews in the first century believed in a resurrection. But that resurrection, the one that they believed in, was something that would happen at the end of time, something God would then do for all his people. I mean, this was a brutal time, and there were lots of Jewish revolutionaries and leaders who were killed by Rome in similarly brutal fashion. Some of them even crucified just like Jesus. But no one claimed that any of them had risen from the dead. No one expected it. At least not right now. Some of those folks might have said that, you know, these folks might be raised at the end of history, at the end of time, but not now. Nobody expected one person to be raised from the dead in the middle of history. These women don't come looking for a resurrection. They only know one thing. Jesus has been crucified, and nobody comes back from that. I can imagine that the darkness probably kept them quiet as they moved through the shadows toward the garden. I wonder, too, if they were remembering that horrific scene at the top of Skull Hill just days before when they literally watched Jesus' life drain from his body. I should probably point out at this point that not only are the women the first ones up on Sunday morning, they're also the last ones to leave the cross on Friday afternoon. Of the men disciples, only John stayed near his rabbi. The rest disappeared. They went into hiding pretty quick. And so the women would have had the most visceral and painful memories from this time around the cross. They would have heard the people making fun of Jesus. They would have seen the sign be put up that Pilate had made that said, "Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews," mocking him. They also would have been witnesses to the tenderness that happened there when Jesus entrusted the care of his mother to John, and when Joseph of Arimathea asked Pilate to give him Jesus' body for a proper burial. It hasn't been that long ago, and so I would guess they could still hear the sound of the large rolling stone falling into the groove that locked it into place. No wonder they asked the question, "Who will roll the stone away from the entrance of the tomb?" But when they arrive at the tomb, they find out they've actually got a different set of problems than they thought they would have. The stone is gone. That problem is solved. But now there's a bigger question. The tomb is open and it's empty. So where's his body? Mary runs back and wakes two of the men, disciples, Peter and John, and she says, "They've taken the Lord out of the tomb and we don't know where they have put him." Now she doesn't say who they are. She just knows that somebody's been messing with Jesus' tomb. As if the indignity of the beatings and the trial and the crucifixion weren't enough, now somebody has to go and disturb his grave. Remember, again, notice, her first thought is not, "Well, he must be risen from the dead." No. Her first thought, as it would be for anyone in those days, her first thought is somebody has robbed the grave. Because grave robbery was not uncommon. In fact, it was so common that one of the first century emperors made disturbing a grave a capital offense. See, thieves would break into the tombs and look for valuables. And since, you know, people had called Jesus a king, he was thought of by some as a royal figure of sorts. Naturally, somebody might think that he would have had valuable stuff buried with him. Never mind that the only possessions he had been gambled over by soldiers at the cross, his clothing. Thieves wouldn't necessarily know that. They would only know this is a fresh tomb and it's ripe for the picking. And that's why Mary, when she sees that the stone has been rolled away, that's what she assumes. Thieves broke in. And not finding any valuable items, they took the body instead. And heaven knows what they're doing with Jesus' body. She doesn't think, of course, he's been raised. No. She thinks he's been stolen and we don't know where they have taken him. So the next few verses of John's account, then, you notice there's a lot of movement. Peter and John run back to the garden. Now they're awake, of course, and interested. And I always love that John includes this detail. He tells us he outran Peter to the tomb. Of all the things he'd want us to, he's an old man when he's writing this, many, many decades later. Peter's long gone. But of all the things he wants us to know that he was young and he was fast and he outran Peter. "Don't listen to anybody else," he says. "Everybody knows I beat him to the tomb." In fact, it's so important he tells us this twice in this passage, just in case we might miss it. But he is fair in telling us that Peter was actually the first one who went into the tomb. John follows him in, and then Peter, and then John, we're told, believes. We're not told what he believes. John puts in parentheses for us that they didn't yet understand about the resurrection. So we don't know what he believes, just that he believes. Peter and John see the cloth that Jesus had been wrapped in, lying there, just like a body would have had, evaporated out of them. They see the piece that was wrapped around Jesus' head, laying off by itself, folded up. It doesn't look like a grave robbery. I mean, why would thieves take the time to arrange the wrappings this way? Why would they unwrap the body to begin with? John believes something has happened, but he's not quite sure what yet. And so there's no answer forthcoming, and that they go back to where they were staying. In the meantime, as they go back, Mary has returned to the garden, where this time she encounters two angels who are sitting in the tomb. So Peter and John were just in the tomb, right? They didn't see any angels. Did the angels just arrive? Were they out on a coffee break somewhere? Or is it possible that Mary is somehow more open, more spiritually sensitive than the men were? And she's able to see the angels when Peter and John couldn't. Maybe that's also why she's the first to see Jesus in his resurrected body, except she doesn't know it's Jesus. She doesn't recognize him. She thinks he's the gardener, or maybe he's somebody else who's moved Jesus' body. It isn't until he calls her name. I love that scene. He calls her name, probably in a way that he has done so many times before. That's when she realizes who she's looking at. And suddenly it all makes sense. Suddenly all the times he promised to rise again come flooding back into her mind. Suddenly she's weeping, not out of sadness, but out of joy. "I have seen the Lord," she tells the disciples. And then there are other appearances. But you know, again, appearances were not unknown in the ancient world. I mean, there are even modern stories of people seeing their loved ones shortly after death, and they claim to see a ghost or an apparition. We even have a story from earlier in Jesus' ministry when he's walking on the water out to the disciples' boat in the midst of a storm. And the disciples don't say, "Hey, look, it's Jesus. Of course it's Jesus walking on the water." No, the first thing they do is they cry out in fear and say, "It's a ghost," right? Later on in the book of Acts, Peter is in prison and he's helped to escape by an angel. And then he goes to the house where he knows that there's a group of people praying for his release. And when the servant girl announces that Peter is at the door, they don't say, "Well, of course he's escaped from prison." No, they say, "It must be his angel. It must be his ghost. He must have been killed. After all, this is a ghostly visitation." So Jesus' appearances could have been written off like that, because nobody expected a resurrection. Have I mentioned that? Non-Jewish writers of the time say resurrection is impossible. Except in all those other ghostly appearances, you could go and you could point to the body. Jesus' body is gone. When you take those two things together, the body is missing and Jesus is appearing in a new body, the only thing the early church could conclude is that what Jesus said really was true. He had, in fact, been raised from the dead just like he promised. And if Jesus had been raised from the dead, everything had changed. The world was now different. All throughout this season of Lent leading up to Easter, we've been considering several words to the cross, several ways that people responded to what happened on Calvary. If you remember, people responded to that horrible event in different ways. And, you know, we still hear some of their responses today. Things like Jesus wasn't who he said he was, or Jesus deserved death, or Jesus was just a criminal who deserved to be thrown into a pauper's grave. And on people will go. And if the story had stopped at the cross, I can guarantee you we wouldn't still be gathering here 2,000 years later to remember this traveling teacher. I mean, he had some good advice, you know, he had some pearls of wisdom about how to live. But if his life stopped at the cross, he was nothing more than just another religious teacher. If the verdict of the ancient courts were right, if the cross was all there is, we'd be wasting our time here. In fact, one of the early Christian writers, Paul, said that. He said, "If it all ended at the cross, your faith is futile. And we might as well go home right now and eat chocolate bunnies." Paul goes on. He says, "If only for this life we have hope in Christ, we are of all people most to be pitied." But when you combine the evidence of an empty tomb, missing body, and the many bodily appearances of Jesus, you come to a different conclusion. Maybe those first followers were in fact right. Jesus was raised from the dead. In the middle of history, with a new body that had new properties, it was the same and yet different. Friends, Easter is critical because without the resurrection, there is no good news, and I've got nothing to proclaim to you. But as Christ wrote, as Paul wrote, Christ has indeed been raised from the dead. Here's how preeminent New Testament scholar N.T. Wright puts it. And it's a rather lengthy quote, but I think it's important what he says. He says, the resurrection is a sign that the verdict of the courts has been reversed. The Jewish court tried Jesus for blasphemy and found him guilty. The resurrection declared that he really was God's son. Pilate's court tried him for being a would-be rebel leader. And though Pilate didn't really find Jesus guilty, he's handed him over on that charge. The resurrection declared that Jesus was not the ordinary sort of political king, a rebel leader that some had supposed. He was the leader of a far larger, more radical revolution than anyone had ever supposed. He was inaugurating a whole new world, a new creation, a new way of being human. He was forging a way into a new cosmos, a new era, a form of existence hinted at all along, but never before unveiled. Here it is, he was saying. This is the new creation you've been waiting for. It's open for business. Come and join in. Friends, without the resurrection, the cross would be incomplete. Without the resurrection, there would be no Christian faith. Jesus would most likely have been forgotten. First of all, by the disciples who followed him so closely. As I said, they may have, extracted a few pieces of advice to live by. But without Jesus rising from the dead, what reason did they have to continue his ministry? And it gets even better. Because Jesus' resurrection, Paul says, is the promise of our own. This is not something God did just for Jesus as his son, and then he withholds it from everybody else. No, Jesus' resurrection is the promise of our own. For those who trust in him, resurrection is our destiny. And we're not talking about, the cartoon idea of sitting on a cloud and strumming a harp. That's not what it is. We're talking about being given a resurrected body, a new body that's continuous with this one and yet different, made to live forever, which is good because the one I've got's wearing out. Jesus' resurrection is not a miracle to prove Jesus was divine. Jesus' resurrection was the first of every other resurrection to come. It's the promise of our own. It's a preview of coming attractions. Now, here's another question I have this morning. You ever wonder what Jesus did in between Friday afternoon and Sunday morning? I mean, his body's in the tomb. Maybe he was taking a nap. What was he up to? If you remember, on Friday, Jesus told the rebel on the cross next to him that he would be with him in paradise. When did he say that was going to happen? Today, right? Today, I mean, I assume that meant Friday. That was the day they were on, the same day. So there was somewhere for a repentant rebel to go that very day, an experience that we typically call life after death. He would be with Jesus in some fashion, whatever that looked like, Friday to Sunday. But that wasn't resurrection. When Jesus walked out of the tomb on Sunday morning, something new happened. One man raised from the dead in the middle of history was not what anyone expected. And yet because of that one man, an entirely new way of life, a new way of living began. N.T. Wright calls it life after death. It's a new bodily life in the presence of God forever. Jesus' resurrection promises that one day we will live in God's space, in that place where God dwells with his people, a new heaven, a new earth, all together. It'll still have that new heaven and new earth smell, I think. Jesus' resurrection isn't just about going to heaven when you die. It's about a whole new quality of life and a way of life that begins now and goes on forever. It's what Paul describes. He says, what no eye has seen, what no ear has heard, what no human mind has conceived, these things God has prepared for those who love him. And all of that is possible. All of that is true because Jesus was raised from the dead. His resurrection created new possibilities that we could only dream about before. This then is the good news. Jesus fulfilled all the ancient hopes more completely than anyone could have imagined. And the same thing that happened to him is possible for us as well, for all of us who put our hope and trust in him. When the cross spoke condemnation and violence into the world, the resurrection responded with hope and love. When the cross tried to keep Jesus quiet, the resurrection responded with joyful song. When the world did its worst to Jesus and told him, "Take that," God responded by raising Jesus from the dead and said to the world, "Take that." In a world of death and dying, in a world of pain and darkness, the light of the resurrection breaks through, brings healing, and says, take that. After all, that's what John says at the very beginning of his gospel, a passage we read every Christmas Eve. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. Jesus is risen. He is risen indeed. And that's why at the end, John hears a voice from the throne saying, there will be no more mourning or death or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. So take that death, take that mourning, take that crying, take that pain, take that old order of things. In the light of the resurrection, you cannot survive. You will not survive. God has turned things upside down, and the world will never be the same again. That's why I remind you every Easter and a whole lot of Sundays in between that the resurrection always means that the worst thing is never the last thing. Several years ago, I took another pastor friend of mine to the Holy Land, and of course, as we always do, we went to Jerusalem to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is the traditional site of Jesus' death and resurrection. And it was, you know, you never know what you're going to get when you go in that church. But this day, there were a lot of people. It was kind of packed. And so we got around the corner to the monument where the tomb once was, and there was a long line. And I kind of looked at it. I've waited in that line before. I mean, it's meaningful to go inside the monument. And I try to if I can, but that day I wasn't feeling it. I didn't want to stand in the long line. And so I decided I was going to wander around, try to see things I hadn't seen before. And as I did that, I ran into Pastor Ken. Now, I knew he hadn't been to Jerusalem before, and he probably wouldn't go back again. So I asked Ken, I said, are you going to go inside the tomb? And Pastor Ken smiled with that wisdom he had for many years of pastoring and said, no. He said, I'm good. I don't really want to wait in a long line to see a place where he is not. I couldn't argue with that. Because, friends, he is not there. He is risen, and the world is forever changed. And that, my friends, is the good news.